Monica, why don't you explain what we're going to have?
So this Friday we're going to have a vision board night/game night. Vision board and game night. Pretty much to start off our semester with our goals and aspirations for this school year and maybe even other goals outside of school.
Good. And then afterwards, we're going to do a game night. Okay, good. And then Sunday, we have worship right here at 10 o'clock. Next week, we're going to have Bible talk at Merced College at 12:30 on Tuesday. By then, it'll be roughly 197 degrees, so we'll see how that goes. All right. And then we'll have midweek here. We'll continue our class on James. And then Thursday, we'll have Wednesday we'll have our Bible study at UC Merced. We've been saying 12, but I think we need to do it at 11:30. That way we can have a Bible talk, and then you can go to class. And then I don't know if that will allow you to come or not, but all right, good. And then next Friday, we're going to have another midweek, and I believe it's going to be a barbecue at our house, and then like a movie night, something like that. All right, very good. So let's get into the book of James. Now, I'll tell you right now, James is not one of my favorite books. Here's why. I like books that have a lot of theology, and James is a practical book. And that might be something bad about me, but I think for most Christians, James is one of their favorite books. That's because most people aren't like me. So, the theme of the book of James is this. The theme of the book of James is our life and our faith need to be aligned. Got it? The theme of James is, here it is on the screen here, it says, living the Christian life, our life must agree with our faith. So as you're reading the book of James, he's going to ask the simple question, what do you believe? And then, are you living that way? Now, one of the reasons I don't like teaching James is because my job teaching James is to get in your face. My job teaching James, honestly, is possibly even to get you upset at me. Because that's what James was doing. He was challenging people. And he's telling them, all right, if this is what you believe and if you're not living this way, then you're a hypocrite. And your faith is not real. So, one of the things about the book of James is my job is to make you feel uncomfortable. And personally, I don't like making people feel uncomfortable. That's just not my personality. All right? But that's the deal. All right, now there are some sub-themes. One of the things about James is it's very difficult to outline the book of James. Now, here's a good Bible quiz. What book in the Bible is almost impossible to outline? That's a hard question. Think about it. A book in the Bible that's so random in its content that it's really hard to outline. No, in fact, people would say Matthew is very, very well organized and very easy to outline. Okay. Okay. Correct answer, Proverbs. Think about it. Now, by the way, you could say that about Psalms as well, but Psalms has some... So, Proverbs. Okay, do you know much about the book of Proverbs? It's like it says this thing, and then it says something else totally unrelated. Okay, got it? Now, there are certain things that are repeated in Proverbs again and again and again. That's like James. The book in the Bible most like James is Proverbs. So James is the closest thing in the New Testament to Proverbs in the Old Testament. Now, when you first read James, you wouldn't think that. But if you try to compare James to any other book in the Old Testament, you're going to kind of come up empty. And if you think about it, it's like Proverbs. And for that reason, although I'm going to give you an outline of James, the outline is almost just to have an outline, okay? But I will have an outline. I'll show it because, you know, when you teach a Bible book, you have to have an outline. How can you teach a Bible book without having an outline. Okay, right? So just like Proverbs, there are certain things that come up again and again and again in James, and those are patience in light of suffering. That comes up not just once, not just twice, several times. Wisdom. You could argue that probably spiritual Christian wisdom, you could argue possibly would be the most important theme in James, which makes sense if it's like Proverbs. And then faith. Right, Faith? It's all about you. But, you know, her name is Faith. And now, obviously, faith is going to be a theme. All right, don't look on the screen. Don't look on the screen. Tell yourself, what is the basic theme of James? Just tell yourself, just without looking. All right, somebody, what's the basic theme of James? Your life should agree with your faith. The things that you believe and the way you act should be aligned. So obviously, faith is going to be one of the themes of the book of James. And then humility. If you know the book of James, when I say humility is one of the themes, you're probably saying, yeah, I guess that's true. God opposes the proud, gives grace to the humble. Okay, got it? Now, who is the author of James? Well, scholars always want to have an excuse to not, you can't get famous from writing a thesis for your doctorate in theology by saying James wrote the book of James. You know what I'm saying? So these experts try to say all this stuff. But the bottom line is, one of the few books in the New Testament that almost nobody questions the writer of, it's James. So which James? Jesus' brother. You say half brother, adopted brother. Yeah. Half brother, adopted brother, yes. There's at least one other James, right?
James Zebedee, right?
One of the sons of Zebedee. But James was killed. Actually, the book of James is one of the earliest New Testament books. Most people don't realize that. Okay. All right. So James, the brother of Jesus, led the church in Jerusalem from somewhere around 35, somewhere between 35 and 40 AD. We know when he stopped leading the church in Jerusalem. We know exactly. And we don't know exactly when he started. The first leader of the church in Jerusalem was Peter. But Peter was probably not in Jerusalem after around 40 AD. So somewhere between 35 and 40 AD to 62 AD. How do we know that's when he stopped leading the church in Jerusalem? Because that's when he was martyred. He was actually pushed from the wall of the temple and died. It's recorded not in the Bible, but in Josephus. Josephus mentions that basically he was murdered, essentially. He was martyred. All right? So the book of James was definitely written before 62 A.D., but most theories have it late in the 40s or early in the 50s. Therefore, it's one of the very first New Testament books. Written before Matthew, probably. Written before Luke. Written before John. And even fairly likely even written before Mark, which was the first gospel. So that, think about that. James is writing at a time when it's somewhat likely none of the gospels have even actually been published yet. So that's kind of interesting. All right. Like I said, we don't know a lot about James, but we do know what we do know about him makes him a great candidate to be the author. Every fact we know about James seems to agree with the things we know about the book. So James asks us questions like this. What is important? The answer is, what is important is things that will last. Anything that will last is important. Anything that changes over time is unimportant. And the things of the world are fleeting. They're always changing. You know, sometimes one political party is in power, the other political party is in power. Everything's changing. But there's a few things that don't change. And one of those is the Word of God, right? And God Himself. They're not changing. So like I said, the book of Proverbs is the closest we have to wisdom literature in the New Testament. All right? Now, James does not have an obvious out. No, just let me make a couple comments. In fact, those things on the screen, they're not in my notes, are they? No, they are. They are there. All right, great. So, James does not have an obvious solid outline, but I will give you an outline in a little bit. It's not like Paul's books. Paul's books begin with theology. Think about Galatians. Think about Ephesians. Not the pastoral epistles, but you know, Romans, Galatians, 1 Corinthians. They all start with theology. He tells you something about God, and then he applies the theology in the practical thing. And James doesn't do that. To the extent James teaches theology, he teaches theology through practical Christianity. All right? Sort of the reverse, in some sense, of what Paul does. All right? So to the extent that James has theology, it's found indirectly from what is taught. All right? So Hebrews is a clearly outlined sermon. Matthew through Acts have a lot of historical content. Revelation has a clear theme. The books of Paul have theology and the practical things. So James is different from all the other New Testament books. Now, suggestions on how to read and study the book of James. 2 points. Number one, read it for practical application more than for inspiration. Okay? If you want to be inspired, read Romans. Read Matthew. Read Acts. Revelation. Any of those. But that's not a good reason to read James. Read James in order to figure out how to live your life. Okay? Similarly with Proverbs. If you read, you don't, I mean, hopefully you read Proverbs once in a while, but after a quiet time in Proverbs, you don't find yourself thinking, I am so inspired today. Yeah. You go away thinking like, oh man, I need to do this and that and the other thing, okay? And number two, read it to be challenged and be willing to be made uncomfortable. When you're reading James 2, 1 through around 14, it's going to make you squirm a little bit. And if it doesn't, then you're not really paying attention. So like I said, James does not lead itself to being outlined very well. But despite that, I'm going to give you an outline, and there it is. Chapter 1, Real Religion. And if you know the chapter, that's one of the verses, real religion is blah, blah, blah. But really, when he says real religion is this, he's summarizing what he's been saying in the first part. And chapter 2, real faith. And if you know much about the book of James, you go, all right, that makes sense for chapter 2. Okay, all right. Chapter 3 through chapter 5, that's over 2 chapters worth of material, is real wisdom. So real religion, real faith, real wisdom, and then the last section, chapter 5, 12 through 20, is the need for prayer. Okay? So let's get right into James 1. That's as far as we're going to get tonight. I don't know if we're going to do 3 or we're going to do 4 classes from James. We'll see. I'm not sure. We'll do at least 3 and possibly 4. All right, so let's read James 1, verse 1. James, right after Hebrews, right? James 1, verse 1. It says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? Now, when James writes this letter, who is he? He is the leader of by far the most important church in the entire Christian movement. Right? Now, you could argue that Paul was more influential in the church, but as far as what was the main church in the entire Christian movement, it was clearly the church in Jerusalem. And James is the leader of the most important church in the entire Christian movement. But how does he start? How does he label himself? Servant. In fact, the Greek word doulos is the same word for slave. So James, the most influential elder, and he was an elder, by the way. Apparently he was married. He was an elder. He was an evangelist and an elder and a church leader. The most influential elder in the entire Christian movement begins by putting himself in the position of a humble slave. And then he writes, verse 1, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. All right, so who's he writing to then if he talks about the 12 tribes? Right, it seems like he's writing to the Jews, but that is not what he's doing. But you see why he gave that answer. This seems like the correct answer. But basically, from the Christian perspective, the real sons of Abraham are anybody who's put their faith in God. So although it seems like he's starting out as if he's writing to a Jewish audience, scholars would say that's definitely not what he's doing. So basically, he's writing, well, this is called a general epistle. That's a technical term, but you know, he's a little technical term. For example, who was the book of 1 Corinthians written to?
Church in Corinth.
First in Corinth. Who was the book of Galatians written to?
Church in Galatia.
All right, that was a trick question because there was no church in Galatia because Galatia is a province, but that's okay. To the churches, technically, in Galatia, okay? But James is a general epistle. It's not written to any particular situation. It's likely there's no single church that has something happening. He's writing to the entire church. Most influential elder and leader in the entire Christian movement, he's writing a letter to all the churches. Okay? He's not talking about Jews, but about us. Romans 4:16. Which says, we are the children of Abraham. Galatians 4:22-31, that says, we are now the true children of Abraham. Paul says in Romans, not all Israel is Israel. That sounds weird. That's like saying, not all tall people are tall. But he literally says, not all Israel is Israel. What he means is, not all physical Israel is spiritual Israel. Okay, got it? So this is a general epistle. Now let's read verses 2-8. All right? Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trial. Now let me stop right there. By the way, see where it says brothers and sisters? In the Greek, there's only one word. All right? And in the earlier version of the NIV, it would say, consider it pure joy, my brothers. So why would he translate it as brothers and sisters? Is that because the new NIV is all getting liberal on us and stuff like that? All right, those of you who know Spanish, when you say hermanos, what do you mean? You mean brothers and sisters. So I've heard people complain, why did they change the NIV if it says brothers? Why do they translate it as brothers and sisters? And the only person who ever says that is always a guy. It's never a girl. So if you ever thought that, be embarrassed right now. Okay? By the way, that has nothing to do with this text. I just threw that in there. It's a pet peeve of mine. What can I say? Okay? Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do. Now, if you tried to outline just that one paragraph, he's talking about three different topics just in one paragraph. It's like Proverbs. All right, but it's connected. And so my job is to make you see how these seemingly unconnected points he's making are certainly connected. All right? All right, so he says we should consider it pure joy. All right, he says consider it pure, unadulterated joy. Now I've got a question. What gives you pure, unadulterated joy? Anybody? Yeah.
Being at the beach.
All right, being at the beach. When Faith is at the beach, she's like, ah. Anybody else? Yeah.
when either I'm telling a funny joke and then people laugh, or like someone else tells a really funny joke and it makes me laugh.
All right. When Zane feels pure joy when he tells a joke that's actually funny. All right. Did you have something? All right, riding roller coasters. All right, so James is telling us, listen to what he's saying here. Listen to what he's saying. He's saying, consider it awesome, amazing. What a great, awesome thing. When what? When you suffer trials of many kinds. Now, I'll tell you, the week before last, I was in Haiti. And I was teaching for the churches there, and it was 95 degrees and 95% humidity, and there's no air conditioning, and I am feeling like I very well just might pass out. And I wasn't just teaching for an hour. I was teaching for 2 hours, and then we had an hour question and answer session. You know what? I'm not kidding. That is awesome. It is awesome. Because you know what? I got through it. And nobody can take that away from me. Yeah. Nobody can take that away from me. I mean, hey. And so James, he's just grabbing you and shaking you from the very first verse. Is he serious? Is James serious? I mean, pure joy when you get COVID? Pure joy when your boyfriend or girlfriend says, no, I don't want to date you anymore? Pure joy when they're trying to kick you out of your apartment? Is James serious? The answer is absolutely. He's not even exaggerating. He's not. What kind of trials? All kinds of trials. There's a lot of different kinds of trials, folks. Trials from persecution. Trials from sickness. From problems within the church. From being tired. There's so many different kinds. Now, why should we have this attitude, according to James? Now, I'm going to guess that nobody here is going to stand up and raise their hand. That's the way I feel about trials. I mean, I don't know. Hopefully, like me, you can say, I sometimes actually do feel that way. Because honestly, I can say, sometimes I'm serious. I'm serious. Sometimes it is awesome to suffer. But not always. No. Yeah. Definitely not always. Okay, so why should we consider it awesome when somebody persecutes us? Go ahead.
When they persecute.
Or whatever it is, whatever the trial is, yeah.
For me, it's easier for me to change my perspective on it if I tell myself it could be worse, or there's a bigger reasoning why. Mm-hmm. Like I lock myself out of my bedroom and I had to buy or had to get a locksmith to come in on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I had to spend money that we don't want to spend. And I was like, you know what? I was going to drive out for the weekend, so maybe I could have gone in a car accident and me leaving my keys inside my bedroom.
Yeah, good. Good. Now, according to that, that's a correct answer, which agrees with what James says here. But let's let James speak. Let's let James speak. According to James, why is it awesome? And like a cause for yippee skippy when we suffer. Yeah, go ahead, Monica.
Because it builds your perseverance, so the next trial may not be as hard for you since you're building your character with that trial.
Who here wants to be a good person? Who here wants to do amazing things for God? Who here wants to be more Christ-like? So how's that going to happen?
Suffering.
In America, do we seek suffering?
No.
Our culture worships comfort. Yeah. I don't know about you, but if I'm in the line at McDonald's, if it takes more than 2 minutes, I'm like, What's wrong with these people? Right? That's just the way we are. But according to James, this is the only way to become complete. I don't know about you. I want to become a complete person. There are holes in my life. There's things I'm pretty good at, and there's holes in my life. There's stuff I really kind of stink at. But if you want to become Christ-like, if you want to have a life that has an effect and makes a difference in this world, no suffering ain't going to happen. And I get the sense that James has figured this out. James is standing there. And by the way, he was eventually martyred for his faith. So it's just not blowing off steam here. Do you want to be strong, mature, and fulfilled disciple? All right, then we need to embrace suffering. We need to be willing to go into situations where it's not unreasonable to expect that it's not going to go perfect. We need to do hard things. We need to sign up for 3 classes instead of 2. That's a little joke there. All right, got it. In the U.S., to say that we have a culture of comfort is to understate the situation. We avoid discomfort at all costs. We have comfort food. We have drive-through coffee. And if we have to wait 10 minutes to get service in a restaurant, we're ready to walk out of there. We have more than 70 varieties of cereal. If you walk into a grocery store, go down the grocery aisle, there are at least 70 kinds of cereal. I'm just talking about the cereal in the box, never mind the hot cereal. We have ready-cooked meals. All right? You don't like advertisements? All right? DVR it. So, does this culture of comfort influence us as disciples of Jesus? Yeah, absolutely. I'm telling you, I'm going back there. I was just in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti, and you guys are a bunch of wimps.
Right?
I want you to look me in the eyes here, okay? You guys are a bunch of wimps when it comes to suffering. And so am I. I'll share about this, the couple that are leading the church in Compassion. And his name is Widler and his wife. And they were asked to move to Compassion to lead the church. But they were living in a part of Port-au-Prince which is completely controlled by the gangs. They have no police, no security. So what they did was they walked out of their house. And that was it. Right? They're asked to lead the church in Compassion. They're living in this place in Port-au-Prince. In order to do it, they literally just walked out of their house with, like, a suitcase. And that was it. Now, for these guys, that wouldn't be a big deal. But for somebody like Faith or somebody like me, for a fully adult, you know, a family with 2 kids, they walked away from all the clothes for the kids, all their clothes, all their dishes, all their pots and pans, all their furniture, and their car. Why? Because if they'd taken anything with them, they would have been robbed. And if you get robbed on the street in Port-au-Prince, you could also get shot. Okay? So when I say I'm looking at a bunch of wimps when it comes to suffering, I'm in the crowd too. You know, I'm in the crowd too. But I'm telling you, we are influenced by the culture of comfort. So what James is doing right out the gate is making you feel uncomfortable. So I have a question for you. What is your attitude about trials and difficulties? I don't expect you to raise your hand and answer right now, but are you willing to do things which cause you risk of being uncomfortable? Okay? It was a little bit uncomfortable on campus today, I'll tell you. And then taking all that stuff back to the car, could you imagine how I was feeling when I got back to the car? Man, I was ready to die. How about sharing your faith? All right, sharing your faith is a little bit uncomfortable. I appreciate how Monica said she was nervous. Once she got going, it's great. Plus, honestly, sharing your faith at Merced College is like, it's actually pretty easy. I've been in places where if you, like Jan and I were in Spain, we were sharing our faith in Madrid, and like over half the people would look at you like you have four eyes or you believe in pixie dust and fairy tales. Like, seriously? You're inviting me to church? As if I would, that's the thing we get there. Are you willing to take a job which has a financial risk in order to be of greater service in the kingdom of God? Would you be willing to move to a place you don't like as much because God, you get the sense that God could use you there? Would you change Bible groups in order to not have your needs met, but in order to meet the needs of the people over there? That's a problem for our churches. I'm telling you. Do you confront sin in the lives of the people that are close to you? Not rudely, not obnoxiously, not angrily. But if there's sin that needs to be confronted, are you willing to confront it? Do you get open about your own sin? Or when you sin, you're thinking, uh-oh, hope nobody asked me about that. Are you willing to take a risk and maybe allow yourself to fall in love when you've been hurt really badly in the past? Are you willing to get serious about your health, your weight, whatever it is? Okay? So that's the first four verses. Then let's reread verse 5 through 8. Okay, what was the topic of verse 2 through 4? Suffering, right? And growth through suffering. And then he changes the subject. This is what James does. It's like, choom, you know, what happened? I thought we were talking about suffering. So he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God. Right, who gives generously to all without finding fault and will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown by tossed by the wind. This person should not expect to receive anything. So there's the practical teaching. And what's the practical teaching? But then we need to connect it to the prior thing. What's the practical teaching? No. In this new section, we're done with that. Right. If you want wisdom, ask for it. Okay. Now, what is the connection between wisdom and trials? See, these don't seem connected, but they are. Because wisdom gives us the level head, which allows us to see the end result of trials. Experience, wisdom. Wisdom says, yeah, this is going to suck. But you know what? If I get through it, you know, because I've seen it. It's not the first time. This is not my first rodeo. I've kind of been here before, and I've seen it. And after a while, you kind of realize, oh, if you go through that and you get through it, you're actually a better person than you were before. So wisdom allows you to anticipate. Now, I challenge you to be willing to go into a situation with risk. But when you do that, you should also do that with wisdom. So there is nothing spiritual about doing something stupid. All right, and I was charged by some friends with being literally stupid to go to Haiti. And you know what? I don't know. Maybe they had a point. All right, so God wants us to be willing to get out there, to get in risky situations, because that's the only way we're going to grow. But there's no advantage to doing stupid things that are almost guaranteed to blow up in your face. All right? So wisdom and trials are closely connected. Wisdom gives us perspective. Think about the wisest people you know. Think about the wisest people you know. Guarantee you, they've been through some trials. All right, I'll tell you, until I had children, I knew nothing.
Right.
Until I had teenagers, I knew nothing. I was an idiot.
Yep.
I had almost zero wisdom until I became a parent of teens. By the way, that's a trial.
Yep.
And we have a mother in this room who's been put through many trials by two of the sons who are also in this room, for those of you out there who don't know that. So wisdom, the Greek word is Sophia. The Greek word Sophia. So if you're being sophomoric, that means you're trying to appear wiser than you actually are. Biblical wisdom implies understanding of God's will. So biblical wisdom, by the way, he's going to give a different definition. In chapter 3, he's going to give a different definition of wisdom. But for now, wisdom means the ability to perceive what God's will probably is, where the Bible does not clearly delineate for us. So wisdom then involves the understanding God's will and then a willingness to live according to that will and to take the path that God is laying out. And Philippians 1:9-10, that's a great passage on that. It basically says, I pray you may be able to determine what is best. So you don't want to be, do you want to be a mature, complete, a whole Christian? 2 points. Be willing to suffer and pray for wisdom. By the way, which is more dangerous, being willing to suffer or praying for wisdom? I don't know. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Do not seek suffering for its own sake. Got it? That is not what James is saying. All right, he's saying, be willing to go into challenging situations in which a reasonable person can reasonably predict that will lead to growth. That's what James is saying. Okay, great. Otherwise, you'll be like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. Some of us don't have much direction in our life. Some of us, we're just figuring it out, okay? Well, that's not the goal. Faith implies a consistent action and direction and going and accomplishing something, not just randomly going through life and I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. Well, good for you. That's great. I'm glad you have a good heart. But how about wisdom? So doubt involves wavering and being unstable. Would anybody accuse you of being a relatively unstable person? A person who does not find themselves able to find a path and pursue it to the end. By the way, if you're less than 30, well, that's somewhat normal-ish. So don't feel too bad about yourself. If you're less than 30 and that describes you to some extent, you know, all right, but don't accept that. Don't say, oh, well, that's just the way I am. No, not good. So on the one hand, the young among us are more likely to step out in faith and do something crazy. But on the other hand, they're more likely to do it unwisely. On the other hand, the old among us are so wise, they stop taking chances. Okay? So, whichever you are, okay, if you're young, probably just keep taking chances, but do it wisely. If you're old, come on, take a chance. All right, James 1, 9-11, how am I doing here? I don't want to go more than about 45.
7:50.
All right, I've been going 40 minutes, so I'm not going to finish the chapter, but I'm going to try to make some progress here. Okay, good. All right, wisdom. Wisdom is understanding God's will. Do you want to be mature, complete, and whole person? Number one, pray for wisdom. Number two, wisely make decisions that cause you to leave your comfort zone. And then stick to the decision. Okay, Romans 1:5-8, do not waver, center. Great. James 1. Did I say Romans? James 1, 9 through 11. The rich and the poor. Here we go. You know, three verses, and we're changing the subject. We've had two subjects so far, right? Are you keeping up? All right, got it? All right, verse 9 through 11. Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position. Now, this is something he's going to keep coming back to, so just hold on. Or as my mother would say, hold your horses. Because he's going to barely mention this, and it's going to be almost frustrating because he's going to switch the subject so quickly. But bear with James. Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position, but the rich should take pride in their humiliation, since they will pass away like a wild flower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls. Its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich will fade away even while they go about their business. All right. So he doesn't spend much time here. He's introducing a theme that he's going to keep coming back to. He's going to keep coming back to the rich and the poor. And he's talking about in the church. He's going to return to this. So why does he bring this up? Because one of the things that gets James really ticked off is people who rely on their wealth for their security rather than on God. They're unstable. Those who rely on their wealth for security, they're unstable. And spiritually, they're unwise. They're going to pass away like a wildflower. Why? Because you can't love both God and money. Matthew 6:24. Do you love money? I get the sense, honestly, the crowd that's here tonight are not particularly materialistic people. I don't think that that's a huge problem for this group, honestly. But he says, those who impatiently endure relative poverty will grow more and more, will be strong in the long run. Got it? That's what Jesus is teaching us. Those who endure relative poverty, not maybe absolute poverty, but relative poverty, relative to the people around you, will grow more and more and will be stronger in the long run. Okay. Now, the Bible does not teach that poverty is a positive ethical good necessarily. He's just saying that if you have a choice, probably being like super rich is not going to be positive for you in the long run. There's a couple of gifts that are very difficult to have, and one of those is the gift of wealth. All right? And, you know, I've been around the world, and I've found that the places in the world that are relatively poor are the places in the world where our church is growing more. And the places that are relatively financially well off are places where the church is not growing very well. All right, so which would you rather be? Part of a church that's growing and doing great things, or part of a church that's sort of languishing and just barely getting by? All right, well then consider moving to a place of less wealth. Honestly, Jan and I to use myself as an example, it's almost embarrassing because we have so much money. But honestly, we didn't exactly move from the poorest place to the richest place. You know what I'm saying? By the way, recent studies have shown that there's levels of happiness. The two happiest countries I've ever been in, I've been in 90 countries, more than 90 countries. The two happiest countries I've ever been in are Cameroon and Cameroon and Guinea. You may not know much about countries Cameroon and Guinea. I've been to each of those. Not New Guinea, Guinea. There's actually two countries named Guinea in Africa. There's Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry. And it doesn't matter, but I'm telling you, the poorest country I've ever been in is Guinea. It's the poorest country I've ever been in. And Cameroon would be one of the five or six poorest countries I've ever been in. I believe there is an inverse relationship between wealth and happiness of the culture. Inverse relationship. Does the average American believe that?
No.
But actually, another study, this is measuring happiness, a different version of it. And they said the happiest country, at least in the developed world, is Denmark.
Really?
Yep. And they asked why. They asked many, many questions. Researchers tell us it's because they have low expectations.
Wow.
In Denmark, they have low expectations. In Denmark, the average citizen, if they have a decent house and have a nice vacation once a year, it's good enough for them.
Wow.
That's the culture. That's not just Denmark. There's also Sweden. I've been there. It's what it's like. Now, I'm not saying that we should have low expectations spiritually, but I think allowing ourselves to have relatively low expectations financially, James is suggesting that's probably a good thing. 1 Timothy 6:6, Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain. Are you content with what you have? Okay, James 1:12. All right, let me get through verse 15. Then I'll feel like at least I came close to finishing chapter. All right. James 1. Well, I'm going to read 13 through 18. Here we go. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. There he goes. He does it again. This is his fourth subject. Subject number one, suffering. Subject number two, wisdom. Subject number three, poverty versus riches. Subject number four is sin. Here we go. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when full grown, gives birth to death. Do not be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters, for every good and perfect thing is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose us. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be like a kind of first fruits of all that he created. So basically saying, beware of temptations that arise from our own desires. Your worldly desires, if given undue attention, are the cause of your own destruction. We sin because we feed our evil desires. Don't tell me the devil made me do it. Don't tell me the devil made me do it. Because James says, that's a lie.
Yeah.
What made you do it? You made you do it. Did Satan put in something in front of you? Sure. Sure. Did he make you do it?
No.
Never. No. God is not your problem and Satan is not your problem. Now, a lot of people say the problem is Satan. I hear that a lot. It's a spiritual warfare and all that kind of stuff. Okay, there is spiritual warfare out there. That's true. But the biggest war you have is with yourself. Your own selfish desires. So the question that James is asking is, do you blame shift? The reason I did that is because you said this to me. All right? The reason I lied is because, you know, this is a situation. The reason I went on to this pornographic website is because I was tired or it was late at night. Whatever. Who did Adam blame?
Eve.
Who did Eve blame?
The serpent.
The serpent. So my question to you is, who do you blame? Or do you accept blame for your sins? Or do you blame it on those who frustrated you or made you angry? I couldn't help it. Look what they did to me. Who's not buying that excuse? God is not buying that excuse. God has not given me a spouse I desire, and that's why, you know, blah, 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 blah. God has not blessed me with a career, and that's why, blah, 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 blah. God is not the problem. It's your lack of godly desire. What is the opposite of worldly desire? Is it a lack of desire? No, it's godly desire. The opposite of worldly desire is not no desire at all. So we need to cultivate godly desires. We need to desire the true gifts, the gifts that are, in quotes, verse 18, from above. What are those gifts that are from above? Well, one of them is wisdom, obviously. Now, I wish I had time to do James 1, 19 through 27, but in my opinion, a Bible lesson that goes to more than 50 minutes in America, And I've gone, 50 minutes and 0 seconds. 50 minutes and 3 seconds. Okay, very good. So we'll call it quits.